his biography. We said he's from Miletus. We also mentioned that
he's from Ephesus. He's from Ephesus, which is a little bit up the shore. So, go ahead. I have something to say about that too. But
oh, I was just gonna say is generally understood that he was probably from a noble family, and might have even been in within the lineage of like the local kings and such. And this kind of plays a little bit into his disdain for the general populace and public, that there's this kind of like he was basically some sort of aristocrat type person, who became like an intellectual aristocrat who kind of shunned his political life and political opportunities, but also never really had much love for like the regular like rabble of people, and was just kind of like
You will read the contempt for the poloi throughout his fragments. He wasn't the first person who felt that way about them, but he is certainly the person who systematizes hating normal people.
He's like, you know who doesn't get anything is farmers. Farmers know nothing. So the next section, we'll get into right into the next section. So now we're getting into some actual fragments. So this is the section, it's called Logos and Senses. Okay, so here's the first one. Those awake have one ordered universe in common, but in sleep, every man turns away to one of his own.
The other thing, so let's read the next one with this as well. The thinking faculty.
The thinking faculty is common to all. So I'll read both those again because they actually match up well with it. Those awake have one ordered universe in common, but in sleep, every man turns away to one of his own. And the thinking faculty is common to all.
So this is interesting, right? Here you have two activities, thinking and being awake and being asleep. Now, we have three terms here. What is the fourth term that is not being stated? Right? And it is essentially non-thinking. It is a going through life, not thinking about things. He's saying that it's possible to essentially sleep while awake. But of course, we don't have a word for that. So he's having to construct some new idea about, he has a new state of what people can be in. And this is somnambulance, sleepwalking, he'll say as well. This is the state that the hoi polloi, that the many are in. They don't realize, again, let's find, this is alluded to specifically in this next fragment. I'll read it. Of the logos, and I should say too, the word logos, it's Greek, but it's not translated into an English term here, just because it's such a multifaceted word that some people actually recommend that you don't even translate it. You just give them the Greek straight, and you just kind of understand what is being said there. So, of the logos, which is as I describe it, men always prove to be uncomprehending. There's that fourth state. Both before they have heard it and when once they have heard it. For although all things happen according to this logos, men are like people of no experience, even when they experience such words and deeds as I explain, when I distinguish each thing according to its constitution and declare how it is, but the rest of men fail to notice what they do after they wake up, just as they forget what they do when asleep. So there is an account of the universe, the logos, and all things happen in accordance with the logos, and also the logos is eternal, right? Before they have, right? So it's an eternal principle. It will explain all things, but there are people who, even if they turn their ears to it, you know, they merely have sound waves enter their ears. They do not comprehend it. They are ostensibly, their eyes are open, they're awake, but mentally, noetically, understandingly, they are asleep, right?
Yeah, and this is this kind of reading of Logos to me has always come across as having some similarities to Xenophanes, where there's this kind of truth. There's, you know, there is this one all-powerful being, God, that makes up reality of some kind, like loosely described. But it's not like that kind of capital T truth is almost impossible to grasp. Even like those who happen upon it incidentally wouldn't even know. But I think that what's interesting for me in reading Heraclitus and this account of Logos is there's this notion of, you know, obviously, and we'll get into it, the world is in flux, things are changing. But one, there's this kind of shared common metaphysical structure to reality, right? Like, you know, he says, those awake have one ordered universe in common. You know, we as beings operate in a world that is not actually purely chaotic. It has some kind of structure to it. You know, the world has some kind of language to it. And if you really, if you're, I guess, ostensibly wise, if you come to really know the Logos, then you can almost kind of start to read the structure of reality.
Yeah, you can start to read. It's interesting. You can start to read what no one understands and yet is common to all. Everyone lives in this one world, and yet so few people have any grasp of the way around it. But if you think, I'm looking at the Greek here. He uses specifically the Greek phronein, which, I mean, if later on Aristotle will use that to mean phronesis as like a virtuous activity and whatnot. There's lots of words in Greek for thinking, so it's important to have that out there. But in any case, thinking is what wakes you up. Even you're awake, you're moving around, your eyes are open, sure, but you're still asleep. How do you wake up even though you are already woken up? You think, and you listen to the Logos.
In the next fragment, he says, therefore, it is necessary to follow the common. But although the Logos is common, the many live as though they had a private understanding. So I think there's this kind of, Heraclitus is getting at this kind of tension. Like there is this metaphysical sort of Logos, there is this structure to reality, there's this language of reality, but most people live as if they're in a dream. Even though they're operating in the real world, they have this way of understanding the world that they perceive to be unique, right? That they, in a sense, they overemphasize their subjectivity, right? You know, we see this with later philosophers and stuff too, where it's like, you know, the world, like the real world, for the average person, is the world that projects from, like, my head. It's the world that I inhabit, and not the world that we inhabit, not the world that envelops me, essentially, the other way around.
Yeah, essentially. Essentially, it is a, other than Xenophanes' early observation that seeming is wrought over all things, this is a further elaboration and systematization of the way that things can seem and seem to particular people. They things seem to someone and they think they understand it or have some kind of private understanding, but really if they paid attention to the understanding that was common to all people, then they would be listening to Logos. They would be thinking, and you'd have to think to do that, right? You would have to make a kind of intellectual leap to be able to understand the way it is for other people, the way it is common to the world.
So, and kind of jumping on that, the next fragment, listening not to me, but to the Logos, it is wise to agree that all things are one.
Mm-hmm. So this is independent of, yeah, go ahead.
I said, I'll just read it again, because I think especially the beginning is really interesting. Listening not to me, but to the Logos, it is wise to agree that all things are one.
Yeah. So this is not, it would be inconsistent for Heraclitus to say, and by the way, I'm the one who's telling you this. It has to be some independent thing. Heraclitus might have his own dreams that he goes to when he sleeps, but when he's really talking about reality, he can't claim on his own that this is the way it is. He has to abide by the same principles just as much as everyone else. He has to point to the same thing.
And this is interesting because it's an interesting fragment because it hints at what we were talking about earlier in terms of, you know, Heraclitus thinking more about the reader and the conversation with the reader and their perception of his text and stuff like that, where instead of just giving out bare facts, he's kind of hinting at how one should think about what he's talking about, right? Like, as you said, it's like he's kind of saying, you're reading this text, but you're not actually, if you're getting what I'm saying, you're not listening to me. You are, you know, reading this text, but really you are listening to the world around you. You are, in a sense, in effect, leaving the confines of the text and understanding the world in and of itself through that, through the relationship with, like, the logos. And that, again, is that's kind of step outside of just, like, giving bare postulations, like, hey, I think the world is like X, right? Again, he's really eliciting the reader to become philosophical themselves.
Yeah, he's getting them to think about the way that the world is. It's not merely a self-contained metaphysical system, even though the resonances between the texts will kind of echo off one another, sure. But the actual referential content of what is being talked about is beyond the text. It does what any good, I mean, it does what any good scientific work should do, which is actually elucidate, not just, it shouldn't just substantiate its own theories, but it should try to substantiate your own experiences and the world in common.
So we'll go to the next fragment now. The things of which there is seeing and hearing and perception, these do I prefer. So, to read again, the things of which there is seeing and hearing and perception, these do I prefer.
Right, and this should make sense, right? Because if we go and we look at that longer passage before, for although all things happen according to this logos, men are like people of no experience, and when they experience such words and deeds, as I explain, when I distinguish each thing according to its constitution and declare how it is, et cetera, et cetera. So what Heraclitus is trying to get people to, again, and this goes to the fact that the text is referring to something greater than just the text itself or to even Heraclitus and what Heraclitus is talking about, you need to go out and experience these things. You need to open your eyes and really look at how things are, thinking about these things using your senses, not just staying close to the way the things seem to you in your private understanding, but going out and realizing the things you see are common to the way that they seem for others. They're consistent with the logos. They're one in that.
Yeah, and it's that kind of, again, the sort of beckoning the reader to participate in, like, the reality of the world to understand it. And we don't need to go over, I think we can kind of move on to the next section, but it does seem that Heraclitus, like, just for example, the next fragment's very short, it says, the eyes are more exact witness than the ears. Heraclitus does seem to have this preference towards vision, towards sight in his writing, which I always thought was a little bit interesting in terms of discriminating and understanding the world, that there's some sort of predominance of seeing, at least a little bit to me. The eyes are more exact witness than the ears. This one too, the next, I'll just read it anyways. If all things turn to smoke, the nose would be the discriminating organ. So basically, if all things, you know, if all the physical reality of things we see and interact with and touch, if those things were to turn into a gas, then it would be the nose, which is our primary, you know, feeler through the world.
Yeah, we use the appropriate senses to detect the appropriate things in the world.
Should we move on to the section on cosmos? That's because this is where a lot of our... So here we're going to get into what we call what I like to call the tension stuff. But okay, so the first fragment is the path up and down is one and the same.
Again, notice that element of what's common there, right? So you have the road or the path. What is one person is going up, the other person is going down. You could it would be funny to understand this, but it's kind of silly. But if someone was going down and said, well, I'm going down one road, and the other person was going up, and they said, well, I'm going up a different road. Well, you don't realize you're actually going on the same road, right? The world is common to people, no matter the perspective that they take on it. You think you have some private understanding, but if you really think about it from the perspective of the other person, oh, it's the same road.
There's been a tendency in the past to have this kind of like subjectivist reading of Heraclitus.
Are you talking about the sea is the most water, pure and polluted?
Yeah, sea is the most pure and polluted thing because it's, you know, it's poisonous for men, but it's, you know, life for fishes. You know, with that one and the path up and down are the same, there's this kind of reading that, oh, the world is subjective, right? That it really, what a thing is dependent upon the person participating with that. As we see in the readings, the opposite is kind of true. It's that, you know, what Heraclitus is saying is, and this is where we get into this, the what's often called the principle of opposites, what I was kind of talking about with tension, where it's like, no, the road is in itself both the road up and down. It's not that it's because I'm walking down the road now, it's the road down. And because Steve is walking up the road, it's the road up for him. It's that like this entity, this being can reveal itself in many different ways. It has many different aspects that it actually is. And a lot of those are in tension with each other. They are in opposition.
Yeah, they're in a constitutive opposition. They're in a striving opposition. I mean, that the fragment, the sea is the most pure and polluted water. For fishes, it is drinkable and salutary, but for men, undrinkable and perilous. The stakes are a bit different here than the road going up and down. And maybe that's why fragments like the sea fragment give a more subjectivist reading, because, well, the world has to be like this for me or else I'll die. It's not the same stakes as the road being up and down. But at the same time, Heraclitus is pointing to the fact that, look, there are complementary opposites, even in roads, even in the water here. But it's still the complementary oppositeness of this constitutes it being healthy for fish and unhealthy for humans. If it's good for fish, it has to be unhealthy for some people, or else fish could just drink anything, right?
And that goes back to that world, like that, going back to this notion of the logos, understanding the logos, the world has some kind of structure.
Yeah, it has proportionality. Again, playing on that multifaceted meaning of it, it's not just the account of the world is its proportionality, and that's why Heraclitus chooses the word logos, and why using the word just logos itself is, it's a keen way to read Heraclitus.
Let's jump to fragment 14, because it's kind of getting on this track. In the same river, we both step and do not step. We are and are not. So this is and then the next fragment 15 is the famous one. It is not possible to step twice into the same river. And the account that we've had, we've talked about earlier, was the kind of the flux doctrine, right? Oh, you can't step in the same river twice. That's because, you know, the waters are always flowing. Actually, let's read 16 too, because they're all kind of part of the same structure. Upon that, those that step into the same river, different and different waters flow. I think a very shallow reading is that the you know, it's, oh, there's different waters flowing, therefore it's not the same river. But actually, when you look at all three of these fragments, whether he's talking about the river or he's talking about, like, you, the observer, he's making it very clear that, like, there is this thing that is the river. Like, there's a thing, it's called the river. Specifically in 14, he says, in the same river. And then in 15, he also says, in the same river. And then in 16, again, he goes, step into the same river, right? So, like, there's an object there, right? Like, the river is an entity.
Yeah, Heraclitus is not lost. He's not lost in the flux. He knows that there's one thing there. He's just trying to talk about its nature.
But at the same time, there's that tension of, but yeah, like, it is, like, rivers are always changing. But it's interesting how he includes in fragment 14, he says, you know, in the same river, we both step and do not step. And then he says, we are and are not. And so this comes back to this, like, there is, I think it's also a very structurally almost the exact same reading, but of the person, right? Like, that you obviously have, like, there's this tension here, like, it's not just the river that's changing, that's an entity. It's also you as a person, as a being. There is this entity that is you. There is this subjective entity, obviously, like, but at the same time, intention in this relationship of opposites, it's never solidified, you know, it's never, you know, permanent as some kind of thing.
You have to recognize too that in the same river we both step and do not step, we are and are not. The fact that we step into the river, you know, we get water on us, now we're constituted by a little bit more water. Our not being is constitutive of us moving into that river. Our not being wet at one point and now changing into something else is us stepping into that river. We go into the forest and we hear different things. Now there's different vibrations in our ears. You know, we eat and we're hungry at some points. We are and are not what we are. And that is constitutive of exactly what we are. There is, again, that constitutive tension that is maintaining something that the Logos, I shouldn't say Heraclitus is saying, but the Logos is saying is there, right? Even though it's constantly undergoing changes. And that's why Heraclitus is taking the tact of not mysticism or the mysteries, but specifically saying that there is something inherently paradoxical and something inherently strange about reality, the way that things are and are not. Those can be true for Heraclitus, it seems.
So we're talking about this, the principle of opposition and the Logos. If we jump down to the 20, actually, let's do 19. Because we kind of 17, 18, are we sort of touched on them already. But if we go to 19, what is in opposition is in concert. And from what differs comes the most beautiful harmony. And you have, do you want to read the Lyre fragment, XF6F. Well, I don't have that in my text.
Yeah, I will read that. So this is, if there's one fragment that has been sort of centered in readings of Heraclitus, it's this fragment. They are ignorant of how, while tending away, it agrees with itself, a back-turning harmony like a bow or a lyre. So we've been talking a lot about these constitutive tensions, right? Think about let's take the bow. It's the simplest example here. Think about how when you string a bow, the bowstring is restraining the flexing of the bow. So the bowstring is stretching out a little bit because the bow shaft is trying to pull it away. But the bow shaft won't pull as far as it can because it's being restrained by the bow. It is an apparatus. It's a metaphor for the way that tension is constitutive. Because if you think about it, if you unstrung that bow and you just had the limp string and that straight shaft on the ground, you don't really have a bow, or you don't have the being of the bow, do you? You have the parts, but the parts aren't in the right relationship yet. And it's that constitutive tension that is the relationship for the being of any given thing. The fact that things are constantly fighting each other, the bow and the bowstring and the bow shaft, in a mutually sustaining warfare with each other that allows them to be what they are. Just like how the person stepping into the river isn't, they don't naturally have water all over them, but not having water all over them is what allows them to go into the river and then become drenched. The being of a person who can become wet is that they have to not be wet. There's that tension there.
This is where Heraclitus often brings up like notions of violence or war. In fragment 21, he says, it is necessary to know that war is common and right is strife, and that all things happen by strife and necessity. So just as you're talking, like, for things to be what they are, for things to have some sort of existence, to have some sort of, like, being as a particular kind of entity, to sort of enter their, you know, their, I guess you would call their ontological constituency or something like that, like, they can't just be they have to be there. They like all things in the world, all things through the logos exist in a kind of a state of what he calls war. But this tension of human mortality, we exist as like living beings, is this structuring, is this kind of non-being that sits on, you know, we might say on either end, that gives coherence to what I'm like, this living thing. But the only reason I'm this living thing is the fact that like I wasn't living. I wasn't living in air quotes, and will ostensibly will not be. And that makes things like sensical in the way that we really understand stuff. I would be a completely different entity if I always was and always will be.
It's interesting because according to Heraclitus, you wouldn't, that if something didn't have any kind of internal difference within itself, it wouldn't be a being at all. I mean, to a stick and a string is not one thing, but a bow is one thing. I mean, the fact that we got to the bow and lyre fragment is important. That really gets to the core of at least Heraclitus' ontology and his metaphysics. And going forward, we were talking a bit about the common world. There is a sort of ethical component to Heraclitus that he's not seeking outwards like Xenophanes and the other Milesians, but he says, I sought myself. I sought for myself. Heraclitus is one of the Ionian thinkers who apparently, we don't have any reason to think that he left Ephesus, unlike Thales, unlike Xenophanes, unlike Pythagoras, who are all well-traveled. So there is something to be said for Heraclitus' way of thinking, that he can hunker down, think about and discourse with and point towards the Logos and really come up with something radically new. I mean, obviously he's like responding to these people, so he's aware of what they're thinking. He didn't have to, as he said as well, you know, being a polymath does not teach understanding. They went out there, they learned all kinds of things that's interesting, but they don't have the insight that Heraclitus has into the Logos, that things are constituted by their relations in this way.
Thank you for listening. This has been the Canadian Philosophy Show.
Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca. You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
Take it farther than you need to. Like a liar, I'm not sleeping once again. But it's fine, just say that it's alright and I'm your friend. Time to do the thing we're not supposed to do. So I'll meet you in the bathroom. Tells me that she wants to be a kid again.